Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
From VOA Learning English, this is As It Is. Today, we talk with a U.S. State Department official about the agency's latest report on religious freedom around the world. The official says violence based on religion harms religious freedom. Later, we look at a study of Turkish public opinion of issues inside and outside the country's borders. Turkey holds parliamentary elections next month. Now, here is Mario Ritter with the story on religious freedoms.
The biggest barrier to religious freedom is the use of religion to justify violence, according to a U.S. State Department official on international religious freedom. David Saperstein is the State Department's ambassador at large for international religious freedom. He is the first non-Christian to hold the position. In the past 18 months, there has been an increase of terrorist acts from those who falsely interpret religion to justify their violence. The ambassador made the statement as the State Department released its yearly report on international religious freedom. Non-state militant groups named in the report include the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, Boko Haram in Nigeria, and Al-Shabaab in Somalia. The State Department placed attention on the Islamic State group for abuses in Iraq and Syria. It noted a case in which an extremist ripped a 3-year-old girl from the arms of her Christian mother and forced the woman onto a bus, threatening her with death if she did not obey his orders. The report said the mother was never to know what became of her daughter. Another issue of concern was the repressive use of blasphemy laws. These laws target minorities whose practices may offend the majority. Mr. Saperstein said such laws are inconsistent with international human rights and fundamental freedoms. He said the U.S. would continue to call for their repeal. Mr. Saperstein noted a third point of concern. He said some governments have used measures to fight terrorism or extremism to repress religious groups or place restrictions on religious activities. He said Russia has used vaguely formulated anti-extremism laws to justify raids on homes and religious places and the seizure or banning of religious material. Speaking of China, Mr. Saperstein credited the country with some reforms. During a recent visit, he saw faith-based groups operating homeless shelters, soup kitchens, and orphanages. But issues of concern remained.
The worsening situation of the Tibetan Buddhist community and the Uyghur Muslim community is clearly a source of concern. The ongoing oppression of non-traditional groups like the Falun Gong remains a source of concern. And the very ubiquitous effort at control under the registration process and the approval process that every church or mosque or temple has to get in order to function from the government, is a continuing problem.
Mr. Saperstein said there is a need to give a voice to people who are religiously oppressed. He added, however, that religion in China was spreading. Katrina Lantos-Sweat, chairs the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom. The commission writes its own yearly report of countries. She said, "There's a lot of evidence out there from many credible sources that societies that do a good job protecting this fundamental human right also tend to be more peaceful. They tend to be more economically prosperous." Some experts see problems in some religious freedom efforts. Elizabeth Shachman Hurd of Northwestern University has said expanding the importance of religious identity can draw the attention of extremists. She said, "When they're singled out for protection on the basis of religion, that actually can make things more difficult for them, paradoxically. Policies toward Christians in Pakistan and Muslims in Myanmar are examples of this," she said. She said the civil war in Syria has been turned into a religious conflict partly by Western groups and by the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. Critics of calls for greater religious freedom say they only reflect Western values. Elizabeth Shachman Hurd agrees there is a double standard. The U.S. Constitution prohibits the government from interfering in the religious practices of citizens. But the 1993 Freedom of Religion Act recently presented a problem. The law was meant to be an effort to increase religious freedom in the United States and has been adopted by many states. But some businesses have used the law to deny services to gay and lesbian marriage ceremonies. This resulted in state efforts to make changes to the law. I'm Mario Ritter.
A new study of public opinion in Turkey shows deep divisions in how the Turkish people view their country and the world around them. This study comes as Turkey heads towards a parliamentary election on November 1st. Jonathan Evans reports.
A new study of public opinion in Turkey shows deep divisions in how the Turkish people view their country and the world around them. The study comes as Turkey heads towards a parliamentary election on November 1st. The survey reports on two major issues: distrust of major powers outside of Turkey and fear for Turkey's economy in the future. The Pew Research Center is an independent organization that studies social trends around the world. The center collected the opinions of the Turkish people as part of its Spring 2015 Global Attitudes Survey. This survey gathered opinions between March and May 2015. The results of the survey show that Turkish people have negative opinions of many foreign powers. 58% see the U.S. negatively, and 64% see Russia the same way. 49% see the European Union negatively. But 55% still want Turkey to become a member of the EU. Turkey is a member of NATO. However, 47% say that Turkey should not use military force to defend a NATO ally if Russia attacked the ally. In addition, only 38% support the U.S.-led effort to fight the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. Another important issue covered was the future of Turkey's economy. 52% of Turks believe their children will face poor financial situations when they grow up. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And that's our show for today. I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for joining us. Tune in tomorrow for another As It Is from VOA Learning English.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. If you are a man living in China and smoke, you may want to stop. That is because 1 in 3 of all the young men in China will die from smoking cigarettes or other tobacco products. Researchers reported their findings in the Lancet Medical Journal. The report says about 2/3 of young Chinese men become cigarette smokers, and most start before they are 20 years old. Unless they stop, about half of them will eventually be killed by their habit. The researchers conducted 2 large countrywide studies on the health effects of smoking. The first study took place in the 1990s and involved about 250,000 men. The second study was launched only recently and is continuing. This study involves about 500,000 adults, both men and women. Researchers say that in China, the number of deaths each year resulting from tobacco use will rise from about 1 million in 2010 to 2 million in 2030. They warn that the number will rise to 3 million by 2050. Researchers say there is no silver bullet to make these numbers go down, meaning there is no easy answer to make the problem go away. People need to stop smoking. China smokes more than 1/3 of the world's cigarettes. It also has 1/6 of all smoking-related deaths worldwide. The story is different with Chinese women. It seems not many women are smoking in China today. 10% of women born in the 1930s were smokers. But among those born in the 1960s, only about 1% smoke. And the rates of death by cigarette among women have also dropped. But that could change. Researchers note that smoking now seems more fashionable among Chinese women. Some women think it makes them seem more appealing. Richard Pito is a professor at the University of Oxford. He helped to write the report on smoking. He said increasing the price of cigarettes may be one way to reduce smoking rates. He said that over the past 20 years, tobacco deaths have been decreasing in Western countries, partly because of price increases. For China, he adds, a large increase in cigarette prices could save tens of millions of lives. More information about our quoted expert, Richard Pito, can be found on the website for the University of Oxford. There it says Richard Pito's investigations into the worldwide health effects of smoking have helped to change national and international attitudes about smoking and public health. He was the first to describe clearly the future worldwide health effects of current smoking patterns. Mr. Pito was knighted by Queen Elizabeth in 1999 for services to epidemiology. In 2010 and 2011, he received the Cancer Research UK and the British Medical Journal Lifetime Achievement Award. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thank you. welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The most difficult national problem facing the administration of President Franklin Pierce was the situation in Kansas. The territory struggled with the issue of slavery. Pro-slavery settlers elected a representative to Congress. Then, they won a majority of seats in the territorial legislature. An investigation found that people from the neighboring state of Missouri had voted in the elections illegally, yet the results were accepted. The new Kansas lawmakers did not like the territorial governor. They demanded that President Pierce dismiss him. Pierce agreed. This week on our series, Ray Freeman and Steve Ember continue the story of the presidency of Franklin Pierce, and they talk about the presidential election of 1856.
Anti-slavery settlers in Kansas felt they could not get fair treatment from either the president or the new governor. So they took an extreme step. They formed their own government in opposition to the elected government of the territory. Their political group was known as the Free State Party. Party members wrote their own constitution and chose their own governor.
President Pierce said the actions of the Free State Party seemed revolutionary. He warned against violence. He said if party members attacked any officials or property of the territory or the federal government, party leaders should be charged with treason. The president gave the pro-slavery governor of Kansas control of troops at two army bases in the territory. Many people feared that the governor would use the troops to arrest the leaders of the Free State government.
Fighting between the two sides almost began when a Free State man was killed by a pro-slavery man. Free State settlers gathered in the town of Lawrence and organized a defense force. At the same time, hundreds of pro-slavery men crossed the border from Missouri. They planned to go to Lawrence and burn it to the ground. The pro-slavery governor and the Free State governor agreed to hold an emergency meeting. They negotiated a settlement, and the men on both sides went home. The truce did not last long.
In the weeks that followed, a number of attempts were made to stop or arrest the leaders of the Free State government. Pro-slavery officials urged private citizens to help. Once again, hundreds of men, including many from Missouri, gathered in Kansas. Once again, their target was the town of Lawrence. This time, however, there was no truce. The pro-slavery mob attacked and burned several buildings. A number of people were killed. The violence might have ended quickly, but one of the men defending the town believed that the battle against the forces of slavery must continue. And he believed that God had chosen him to lead it. The man was John Brown.
John Brown heard that five Free State men had died in the attack on Lawrence. So he said five pro-slavery men must die in return. He led a group that seized and killed five people. The civil disorder in Kansas continued. Settlers were forced off their land. Houses were burned. More people were killed. The territory became known as Bleeding Kansas.
It was clear that there were deep differences between the northern and southern American states. The differences involved their economies, their systems of labor, and their way of life. The civil disorder caused by these differences was the chief issue in the presidential election of 1856. Three political parties offered candidates: the Democrats, the Republicans, and the Know-Nothings. The Whig Party did not offer a candidate. The party had gone out of existence by then. Its members had split over the question of slavery in the Western territories. The split could not be healed. Many Southern Whigs joined the Democratic Party. Most Northern Whigs joined the Know-Nothing Party.
The Know-Nothing Party began as a secret anti-immigrant organization. It feared that too many people from other countries were coming to live in the United States. Members did not want to admit that they belonged to the group. When asked, they said, "I know nothing." And that is how the organization got its name.
The Democratic Party was led by President Franklin Pierce. Pierce wanted to run for re-election. Many Northern Democrats, however, objected to his support of the pro-slavery legislature in Kansas. Other Democrats did not think he was the strongest candidate. As a result, Pierce faced competition for the party's nomination. One opponent was Senator Stephen Douglas of Illinois. Douglas had great political ability. He also had many political enemies. He was the man most responsible for gaining congressional approval of the bill that opened Kansas to slavery.
Pierce's other opponent for the Democratic nomination was James Buchanan of Pennsylvania. Buchanan was a Northerner who would probably leave the South alone. "I am not friendly to the idea of slavery," he said, "but the rights of the South, under our Constitution, should have as much protection as the rights of any other part of our Union."
The Democratic Party met in the city of Cincinnati, Ohio. It was the first time a national political convention was held that far west. Candidates needed 2/3 of the votes to win the nomination. After several days of voting, no candidate had received enough. So, in an effort to unite the party, Stephen Douglas offered to withdraw. James Buchanan got his votes and the nomination.
The Republican Party was a new political party. Its members opposed slavery for either moral or economic reasons. Many Republicans were abolitionists. They wanted to ban slavery everywhere in the United States. The majority of Republicans, however, were not abolitionists. They had no interest in ending slave labor in the South. They simply did not want slavery to spread to other areas. The Republican Party held its presidential nominating convention in Philadelphia. For months, party members had spoken of just one man. He was John Fremont. Fremont had explored the American West. He had been a senator from California. He was young and exciting. Republicans thought he was the right man to lead their young and exciting party.
The The Know-Nothing Party had a divided nominating convention. Northern and Southern members agreed on policies that denounced immigrants, but they split on the issue of slavery. Northern members opposed it. Southern members supported it. Delegates to the convention chose a candidate who seemed to support the party's policies. Yet he was not even a member of the party. He was a Whig, former President Millard Fillmore. Northern members refused to support Fillmore. They broke away from the Know-Nothing Party and supported the Republican candidate, John Fremont.
Fremont could not expect to win any votes in the slave states of the South. He would have to get all of his support in the North. He would have to win the votes of the big states, including Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania was the home of the Democratic candidate, James Buchanan. Buchanan had said that the constitutional rights of the Southern states should be protected, so he could expect to win some votes there. When all the votes were counted, Buchanan was elected. Now he would have to deal with the problems that presidents before him had not been able to solve.
James Buchanan was 65 years old. He had served in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. He had served as Secretary of State and as ambassador. He was a good diplomat, but he was not considered a strong political leader. Buchanan usually supported the Southern position in the dispute about slavery. He said the North should stop interfering with the South. He even said the South had good reason to leave the Union if Northern abolitionists continued their anti-slavery campaign. As president, Buchanan believed he could solve the slavery question by keeping the abolitionists quiet. He wanted a cabinet that shared and supported this idea. We will tell about James Buchanan's administration in our next program.
Our program was written by Christine Johnson. The narrators were Ray Freeman and Steve Ember. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs can be found, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.